That piece from Walt Whitman that Deirdre shared with you, came from my choir sang a Walt Whitman piece a couple of years ago, and one of the members brought the preface to share with us, to inspire us with his words. It's actually a 3-page preface, so you got about 15% of it, and it goes on pretty much like that with very limited punctuation. But I found that very, very inspiring. Whitman was not well understood in his day. He was part of the Transcendentalist movement, which is on the Unitarian side of our history. Ralph Waldo Emerson is the best known person to come out of that, the Transcendentalist expression. Whitman was a bit of a wild man, made people uncomfortable. Some people called his work vulgar. In fact, he was fired from his clerk position with the Department of the Interior when his boss read The Leaves of Grass, because he felt like no one who wrote stuff like that should have anything to do with the federal government. So Whitman scares me. He scares me. That's a big challenge. You know, you get drawn in. Oh, I want to be like that. But it scares me. I can't throw away everything I've known. I don't want to erase all my files and start over again, which is what I'm hearing him say. I'm afraid to be that open to the world. It's very hard to be that open. Now, not too many years ago, I actually made a pretty significant decision to be that open, and that was the decision that I made to go into the ministry. I actually knew that I wanted to be a minister in my early 30s, and I found that out right here in this space. I was a member here in the early 90s, and the minister at that time was Eileen Karpeles, an interim minister. I'd never seen a woman minister before. I'd never been to a UU church before. And I started coming here, and I'm sitting out there, and I looked up and I saw her, and I felt my heart. I felt this rush in my heart saying, that's it. That's what I want to do. I wanna be that. And 15 years later, after hearing that call many times in my ear, my career at the University of California progressed. I started making more money, more responsibility, getting very comfortable with my lifestyle, very comfortable with the fact that I was respected and well-regarded in my work. I had authority. It was very hard to consider throwing all that away. And then just before my 50th birthday, I looked around and saw that some of my friends, not too much older than me, had died of cancer in the last few years. And I thought, you know, if I know what I want to do, I need to get out there and do it. And so I took the leap. Now, it doesn't mean that my fear went away. I was 50 years old when I entered seminary, and I think my biggest fear was that nobody would want me because I was too old. But I was also afraid that maybe no one would want me. I wouldn't find a job. I'd given up my job, and I would be old, and I wouldn't have enough money to take care of myself. Deep fears, but not unreasonable fears. I think the most insidious thing that kept me from doing it, each time the little voice would remind me that I felt this call, was that, you know, my life was really good. I had a good job. I had good money. I had a lot. Why do I want to muck with it? Right? Why do I want to upheave? Why do I want to turn everything upside down? Now, with that in mind, I think actually the Rumi poems are more intimidating in a way than Whitman, because Rumi's a little insidious. You know, he's got that whispering thing that he does. You know, the door is round and open. Rumi calls us to step outside of our comfort zone and challenges us, really, in a deep way. I love that line, you carve too many little figurines. I think of those as all the little idols that we hold up, you know. The little figurine that says, well, it has to be the way it's always been. The little figurine that says, I like my lifestyle. The one that says, you know, I want to have lots of money, right? All those little figurines, you can just line them right up here on the front of the podium, and they create a barricade to our openness, to our willingness to change. I remember my first job when I was in my 20s. I went to work for the federal government. I was about 25, and there were people there, maybe in their late 40s, maybe 50s or so, and they would say to me, I'm miserable and I hate my job every single day, but in 15 years, I can retire with a full pension. Little figurine, maybe it's a big figurine in that case. So here I am. I took the leap, started on this path. Now imagine those of you who have pretty established careers, if you threw that away and started all over again with some brand new thing where you had to start at the bottom, you didn't know anything, you were learning. I want to be open to the possibilities of what this ministry path can offer me. There's a lot of humility in making a change in your life, but my goal has been to be as open as possible to what is coming forth for me. I found this great book called The Art of Possibility. It's by a therapist and an orchestra conductor. And they give you some, every chapter has like a tip how to be open, the art of possibility, how to live into the possibilities. Some of the ones that I liked were let go of this idea that if you gain, somebody else loses. You know, like there's the pie is only so big, and if your piece is bigger, somebody else's piece is littler. Or this idea of measurement, you know, well, I'm 40 years old, I'm supposed to be at this place. Or comparing yourself to others, measuring yourself according to some other measurement that actually kind of blinds you from all the possibilities that may be shining out there and calling to you. One of my favorite stories in the book was about a class that the orchestra conductor taught. I think it was at the Boston Conservatory or some high caliber music school, a graduate class in performance. So he had all these uptight students who had been struggling to perfect their craft, to perfect it so much that they were terrified of making a mistake. And it really blocked their ability to engage with the music and express themselves fully. So he sort of pondered what his options were to open these students up, and he decided that he was going to give them all an A on the first day of the class. He thought this might, you know, they weren't going to be worried about achieving what the class expected. But in order to get that A, they had to write an essay. And they had to write this essay as if it was at the end of the class, using the future tense, using the tense of the future, and tell him how they had changed, that they deserved an A, how they had insights that inquired about themselves, ways that they transformed the way they were performing their music. So they had to project out themselves that deserved an A. So here's one of those letters. I got my A because I had the courage to examine my fears, and I realized that they have no place in my life. I changed from someone who was scared to make a mistake in case she was noticed to someone who knows that she has a contribution to make to other people, musically and personally. Thus, all the diffidence and lack of belief in myself are gone. I have found a desire to convey music to other people, which is stronger than the worries that I had about myself. I have changed from desiring inconsequentiality and anonymity to accepting the joy that comes from knowing that my music changes the world. Now, how lovely is that, that she could vision this self? Clearly, you can see in there some of her own fears that she's trying to just pierce right through to the other side of this new, transformed way to engage with the world. Many students in the class, after they wrote that essay, said that they were excited to come to class to see what was going to happen to them next. Being open to the possibilities and the students and their experience and in our own lives, neuroscientists have learned that the brain is actually a lot more elastic and changing than they thought early on before they had all these techniques now where they can measure brain activity. They're learning that we can actually change our neural pathways. So if there's a type of thinking that we're stuck in, we can work to change those neural pathways and create new and fresh ones. And we can invigorate all of our brain activity by engaging in different ways. There's a part of our brain that manages our impulse control, but it also suppresses our creativity to a certain point. And so it's it's useful to challenge the things that hold us back. I was very, very captivated by some readings about different brain tumors that actually cause people to discover talents that they didn't know that they had. There's several stories that you can read about people who have brain tumors, or they had brain surgery for some problem and suddenly they can draw or they can paint in vivid colors where before they couldn't even draw a stick figure. Rumi says, inside you, there's an artist that you don't know about. Now, of course, I wouldn't want to wish a brain problem on anyone, and I would extend my complete compassion to anyone that is suffering from that difficulty. I guess the question about being open to the possibilities is, will our fear and insecurity win out over our desire for creativity and newness and fresh ways of seeing the world? Remaining open to the possibilities requires love. But I want to talk about some very specific types of love. You've probably heard about the words eros and agape. Eros is commonly thought of as like love, and the romantic type of love. Agape is the love that Jesus talked about, the love for your fellow beings. Process theology brings us a different context for these ideas of eros and agape, and particularly I'm speaking to the work of the theologian Catherine Keller. For her and for other process theologians, eros and agape are two dimensions of God, two dimensions of the divine love that we have. Eros being this lure, this call to newness and change and inspiration. Like Whitman, Whitman is all about eros. Throw yourselves out into the field, live with your heart. That's totally eros. Whereas agape is about that all the compassionate love, the love that holds us. On the eros side, the example that I have that really speaks to me is a couple whose wedding I did last year. They're an accountant and an engineer, and they had a great spreadsheet for their wedding. Detailed times of everything. Loved it, loved it, loved it. But their story kind of belies their engineering accountant energy. They'd been doing some group dates, mutual friends, and then they went out a few times on their own, and then their work schedules didn't allow them to see each other very much. And one of them had to go up for a work training and for 3 weeks and was gone for 3 weeks. And the other one was here in Sacramento, one of the members of the couple. And he said to his friend, I want to go up there. I want to see her. I don't want to wait 3 weeks. And the friend said, well, what do you think's going to happen? He said, I don't know what's going to happen. I just know that I don't want to be without her for 3 weeks. And so he called her up and she's, oh, okay. She hangs up the phone, calls her friend. What do you think this means? And the friend says, well, what do you want it to mean? And she said, I want it to mean that he wants to be with me because I want to be with him. And so they said yes to that eros call, that lure of connection, that lure of love. The agape side of this equation is the love that we shared in that universalist prayer. It's that unconditional love, that holding, that knowing that you're worthy and held and seen and loved. Both parts of these love are necessary, and indeed in a process theology construct, the eros and the agape play out on each other. Eros calls us and lures us and challenges us to be open, and agape holds us in our fears, supports us, and loves us. And we are the eros, and we are the agape for each other. We draw on that spirit of love that's in the world, but we weave it together into our own web of connection. Now, our community has heard this eros call, this lure. People 5 or so years ago looked around and said, you know, I think we need to commit ourselves to re-envisioning our space, re-envisioning who we are in this space, and began the master planning process. Fresh thinking, thinking ahead to who we can be, a 50-year master plan, wanting more, hearing that lure, responding. But then you have the risk, you have the fear. Those of you who haven't heard, we're going to be moving out of this place for a year. We're going to be worshiping together at Sierra Arden Congregational Church at Northrop and Morse Avenue. There are fears with that. The renovation may cost more than we have available to us at this time. There are fears with that. Here's what I wish for us at this point, that we can stay open to the possibilities of what our adventure can offer, that we can respond to this Eros call of the possibilities of our future. Now, some of you, this is like breathing to you. You're like, oh, yeah, it's going to be great. We'll see new things. It'll be great. And please come and see me afterwards, because I want to give you a little badge that says, I'm excited about our adventure. And you could infect other people. You can be that agape eros combo that loves the lure and loves the engagement. So come up and see me. I would really appreciate that. Now, so we're moving for a year. So what can we look forward to there? What are the possibilities of this new adventure that we're going to undertake? Well, the one that really speaks to me is that everyone will be together. We're going to have one service. So you 1130 people have been coming here for years. You may meet some, or 1115 people, you may meet some 930 people that you have never seen before. You could engage with our children. Maybe you could teach religious education, right? I mean, this is going to be a wonderful mixing of us. It's going to redefine who we are as a community, because these connections that hadn't existed before are going to be built. And the new space itself can create some energy, some Eros energy of possibility and openness. There's a courtyard there that's in between all the various buildings. And so you're going to connect with people because you won't have your normal patterns of going to see your friend after the service and standing by the name tag rack, right? You're going to have to develop new patterns, and you'll engage in new ways with new people. And there's a cross, and it's going to be right behind the pulpit. Now, I know for some of you, and I don't want to make light of this, because some people really suffer from post-Christian trauma, and I was one of those people. So do not come to church because of the cross. Come to see me and we'll talk about it, and hopefully you can let go of some of those things that are holding you back. We may learn about our UU Christian roots and get reinvigorated with that idea. The possibilities are open in this new space. Now, what about our fears? This is where we use Eros for the possibilities, Eros love, we use agape love for our fears. And we're going to need extra love next year. We're going to need extra forgiveness next year. We're going to need to remember that this community is more than its building. The San Jose Unitarian Universalist Church, their building burnt all the way to the ground. They lost everything they had, but they were still a church community. Our situation, our community will be someplace else, but it will still be our community. And if people are uncomfortable going to a different place, because the place is important to them and they want to wait, we will welcome them back when they return to our new space. And we will call them up and say, it's great over here, come on, you'd be surprised what happens in this new space. The other fear, we don't have enough money for the project. Yeah, it's likely we won't have enough money for the project. But we may have enough love. We may have enough love to make the right choices. We may have the right enough love to reach out and find the vision that works for us. There are stressful things about renovations, and we need to hold each other in this love as we go forth. So I ask you in this year ahead to be a part of both the Eros and the Agape, to be open to the possibilities of our adventure, our home away from home. To be a part of the agape love that holds us all during this time of possibilities and this time of challenge. Let us be open to the possibilities of this adventure. I am very excited and proud to be a part of this congregation at this time. So I say, Walt Whitman, bring it on. I am not intimidated by you. Rumi, you whisper in my ear all you want. I see that door that's round and open, and I'm going to walk right through it. Because I know that when I hear that call of Eros, that I will be held in the agape love of this community. Eros and agape, weaving this web of love, weaving this interconnected web of all, being together as we go forth into our new adventure. May it be so. Blessed be.